to the types of grand narratives that people tell about the history of biology. And this one is about genetics, actually. And the concept of genetic mosaics, and the phenomenon of genetic mosaics. And it's basically structured around a close reading of a popular scientific paper by Kurt Stern called Two or Three Bristles. For more than 25 years, writes Stern in his 1954 article, Two or Three Bristles, I've looked at the little fruit fly, Drosophila, and each time I find fresh delight. Born in Hamburg in 1902, Stern was no stranger to Drosophila's studies. He had received a grant to study with T.H. Morgan at Columbia in 1924, and in 1931 was the first to demonstrate through chromosomal analysis that crossing over occurred through the physical exchange of homologous chromatin in the fruit fly. It might seem strange to those who are used to thinking about genes as mechanisms for biological determination, but Stern's science begins not with a determination, but a response. For more than 25 years, problem, however, is that Stern's delight in his flies is not easy to characterize. The relationship between all flies and humans is a strange mixture of circumstance, and Stern is clearly implicated with the object of his study in a variety of fascinating ways. He begins his description of the fly where a lover might, at its most intimate, by gazing into its face and describing what he sees and feels. I marvel at the clear-cut form of the head with the giant red eyes, the antenna, and elaborate mouth parts. Stern then lets his gaze fall down the body of the fly, balancing the tenderness in his detailed observations with adjectives chosen to evoke an alien beauty. At the arch of the sturdy thorax, bearing a pair of beautifully iridescent, transparent wings and three pairs of legs, and at the design of the simple abdomen composed of a series of ring-like segments. Yet what is fascinating for Stern is not so much that the fly is incomprehensibly alien, but it's that its otherness strangely mixes with what might otherwise be familiar. A shining waxed armor of chitin entirely covers the body, writes Stern. And through this armor, with surrealistic clarity, the dark colored bristles and hairs project from the light brownish surface of the animal. Delicate, but stiff and rigid symmetry. Especially under close scrutiny, fruit flies mix things that many humans assume are separate. They mix surrealism with order and delicacy with fortification. Flies aren't just woefully messing up human attempts at creating order. Key differences between the physiology flies and humans encourage mixing as a product of different ways of inhabiting the universe. As the 1958 Encyclopedia Britannica film, The Housefly, warns, a fly cannot bite or sting, but its physical structure and feeding habits make it a carrier of disease and death. For instance, the fly has hairs on its feet that are sensitive to taste. This means that a fly can taste its food by walking on it. Humans, on the other hand, have their organs of taste more closely confined to their alimentary canal, allowing for the separation of functions of eating and walking. This is a profound set of differences in the two organisms, as it implies that humans try very hard to keep production separate from consumption, while flies need to mix these things up to live. As a Drosophila geneticist, though, Stern knew the importance of mixing as a disciplinary experimental practice. The fruit fly lives off the surplus of human agriculture. Its primary ecosystem is created by the inability to efficiently triage goods, people, and things. But it doesn't just stop with mixing things up, as once they are mixed, the conditions for new types of outcomes are generated. For instance, the fruit fly is well known for a symbol for the fecundity of life. Robert Kohler, the geneticist, has even called it a breeder reactor. For experiments. Consequently, its ability to commingle and its generativity have made the fruit fly one of the most studied of all living organisms. The inability to completely regulate spaces offered by the fruit fly is an important experimental system in the first place. In the article, Two or Three Bristles, Stern then shifts the focus of his contemplation from the physiological differences between the human and flies to appreciate their similarities. Despite the differences in forms, the two organisms still share similar genetic and cellular processes. And this is what makes flies such a good model organism for studying genetics of humans. And this is kind of what you see a lot of the whole time about why development is such an important an important partner for genetics in mid-century. The vital function of cells and organs in insect and man are alike or very similar. The laws which govern the way in which the insects inherit the parental genes are identical with human heredity. The problems which the egg or of an insect or of a man will have to solve as it develops are much the same. So this is kind of fascinating, right? For something that is so otherworldly in form, it possesses similarities. So although the title of Stern's article seems to point to a single anomaly, what he's really kind of grasping at, right, is a very interesting key question about how similar processes can generate diversity. How can flies and humans be made of similar stuff and yet appear so different? Well, the answer, of course, is how this stuff is put together, how it's regulated. And this is when he turns to the phenomenon of genetic mosaics in his paper. Genetic mosaics are a type of mixing at the level of cellular gene expression. Occasionally, flies develop whose bodies are composed of different genetic parts. Flies with 2X chromosomes, and this is a well-known example, typically become adult females, but sometimes during division, cells with only a single X chromosome might be formed. When these cells divide, they only then produce daughter cells with a single X chromosome. When this fly emerges from the pupa, it combines these different types of X chromosome expressions as a mosaic or patchwork, really swashes of cells across the fly's body. Some areas of the body will have a single X chromosome, while other areas of the body will have 2X chromosomes. And flies don't have the complex hormonal systems that mammals have, so this means that the sexual characteristics of the flies will be expressed differently across the body of the fly. And here's a picture. So this is a gonadomorph, and this is the one that Stu and I were talking about. This particular mosaic splits right down the middle. So it happened right in the first cleavage division. And this is the male side, right? And you see a sex comb, you see different types of bristles. You see the singed bristles here, and over here you see the straight bristles, and here's the abdomen of a female. So it's like half male, half female. Oh, oh. But if it emerges later on in different cleavages, you get different types of patterns across the body. Stern was convinced that the strange mixing of the mosaics responded to some type of order. And he didn't necessarily think that this was a genetic order. He didn't think it was a genetic determinism. He said that these could be determined genetically. But what he said is that what the genes actually do is they respond to a pre-pattern. And the pre-pattern helped the fly develop from a pre-differentiated state of homogeneous cells to a state of differentiated cells possessing different functions and expressing different gene products according to different areas of singularities that are developed within the fly. And this is the words he's using. This pre-pattern could be all genetic, but Stern thought it more likely that it was more complex, that the pre-pattern was composed of signals from a variety of different sources. This suggested that the fly's genes must be responsive in order to mix things at the right time and the right place during development. He's got this great metaphor. I mean, it's a little bit deterministic still, but you can see him really working with this. And he likens it to this notion of the gene response, the responsive genes, as to a series of groups of prospectors working in different regions of a country. Each group would be alike and consisting of men looking for coal, gold, uranium, and so on. In some regions, only the coal prospectors would respond to the coal deposits. In other places, the gold prospectors would respond to the gold veins. At still other places, the uranium prospectors to ores. With this metal, each response would depend on the pre-pattern of geological differentiation. Each response would be necessarily prerequisite for subsequent differentiation in the form of specific structures erected by the mining engineers. Perhaps deep shafts and elevators for the coal mines, surface explanations and washing troughs for the gold, shallow tunnels and radiosensitive installations for the uranium. Jean's and Stern's model were responsive to the pre-pattern that allowed them to effectively triage which protein might be expressed in specific circumstances. And it's also not a coincidence that Stern, his types of mosaics that he used, focuses on sensory bristles, which is not well, because the bristles are sensory organs in himself, right? So they are responsive. Mm-hmm. And he ends up developing, actually, a really interesting theory about how through responsiveness to moisture, how humans and flies get different forms from the same element, right, but develop in different ways. He goes, the fascination of, and he's talking about the differences between the two and how they look differently. The fascination of this view lies partly in difference from the aspect which so many other animals, including man, exhibit. And his language here is actually really beautiful. There's obvious life in the glow of young skin, the moisture of lips and eyes, the relaxation and tensions of muscles and rust in activity, and in the expressions of emotions. There are no such dynamics in the insect, right? Hardly any visible changes are evident when old age approaches. No loosened skin nor weakened muscles disturb the exactly sculptured eternal forms. These visible physical differences between humans and flies mark very different ways of inhabiting the world. They are both defined by an ability to respond, right? So even the flies retreat from the world as an ability to respond, but they respond to it very differently. And it depends on basically their size.
It depends on their size.
It depends on their size and their relationship to moisture. The human's large size guarantees that the loss of moisture won't be fatal. So a drop of moisture in the lips of a human suggests a sensual vitality, a luxurious excess, and not an imminent loss of life. Whereas all small insects like Drosophila have a large body surface in relationship to their volume, thus they must be protected from excess evaporation, or they will soon become dehydrated. So even the hard covering that he was admiring earlier
it's,
on.
It's called chitin.
Chitin, okay.
Yeah.
Or the isoperimetric inequality. Anyway, that's
the large size of humans, on the other hand, allowed them responsiveness to the world, expressed through moisture, as denoted by the sheen of liquid in one's lips or the tears in one's eyes. And the thing that I really like about this particular paper is not, so he's chosen a model that talks about genes as responsiveness. He chooses an experimental system, which is about responsiveness, and he chooses a rhetorical strategy, which mixes together fable, love letter, scientific argument, as a popular lecture, right? And so what really kind of is really interesting for me then is how you see him really reaching across different types of descriptive strategies in order to describe something so remarkable and multivalent, right, as how different forms emerge out of similar materials, mm-hmm. out of water. Something's...
Right.
Yeah.
So I might have missed this, but I mean, so it seems to me a central difficulty, and you might have said this, I'm not sure, but it seems to me a central difficulty would be, where does this pre-pattern come from?
Oh yeah, no, it's...
Right, I mean, yeah. And so, I mean, because it kind of it could reek of a kind of determinism, right?
Well, should I tell you what's known?
Please.
Mother, the female Drosophila, uh-huh. creates the eggs.
Yeah.
The eggs are pretty big, they're half a millimeter long, and maybe a tenth of that, maybe a third of that is high. So it's sort of like a football. And she packs different kinds of molecules into different areas of the egg, some in the front, some in the back, some dorsal, some ventral. So she creates gradients of stuff in the egg, and those are now known to be the pre-pattern. Mm. So, and it's called maternal genes.
But it happens, and it unravels as it's expressed.
Right. Oh, interesting.
So when he says pre-pattern, he's not talking about this is the pattern
yeah.
before the pattern.
Yeah.
He's
yeah.
talking about what happens before pattern formation.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Phillips, right. So what happens is there's these gradients of genes like picoid and pythorax and stuff, and Krupel and NURBS and so on, that are arrayed in spatial patterns in the early in the egg before it's ever fertilized.
Okay.
And then the egg's fertilized, then zygotic genes respond to those gradients and switch on in different areas of the developing embryo.
And then that's what Stern would call singularities.
Oh, okay.
He didn't, yeah, right.
You were hoping for Rupert Sheldrake?
No, okay, that makes sense. No. Yeah, interesting.
Morphological fields?
Yeah. So the more I thought about it, I thought that this is actually kind of an interesting paper, precisely because it takes one of the most determined, what's thought of as one of the most determined fields in biology, genetics, problematizes it, and uses multiple analytical strategies to try to explain why it's important to do that. So,
I mean, the thing that I love about it, this is kind of in a different register, but it also completely complicates the relationship between aesthetic discourse and scientific discourse.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I wrote this piece on this recent art installation that's partly about the extinction and recovery efforts around California condors around the Grand Canyon. And it's a series of photographs of these condors that are frozen at the University of Arizona. And they're all tagged, and almost all of them died of lead poisoning from eating carrion that had been shot by lead bullets.
Oh,
and it's a series of really big format, striking photographs, about 20 of them. But beneath each photograph is an interview with one of the conservation scientists working with these birds, in many cases for years and years. And what's interesting is, in the text of the scientists, you can see them trying to remain scientific, and yet between the lines, all of this anger and frustration and anguish and sadness is bubbling up everywhere, even though they're just trying to quote-unquote stick to the facts about bird number 33.
Right.
You know, and that muddying, or, you know, and whatever you want to call it, the difference between scientific and aesthetic and artistic discourses for me is really, it's just like all over.
It's all over.
It's like a love letter, you know, to the fruit fly half the time.
When was this published? 54?
54.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting year. After all, Watson and Crick discovered the structure of DNA in 53.
Yeah.
Waddington was doing his experiments at the same time that Curtis Stearns was doing.
That's right. 57 is when that book came out.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think this is a really interesting period. And the other thing that I think that's kind of interesting, that's kind of a nice reflector now for contemporary discourse, is how, you know, moving past materiality.
Yeah.
Right.
And then a lot of people doing that, and how they often adopt a discourse of forms or aesthetic register.
Yeah.
And this ends up giving you a way of thinking about how that can happen in a non-deterministic way.
Well, and Stu, it reminds me of one of the most striking points in your last book is the discussion of formal cause laws.
Yeah.
And the independence of formal cause laws from a material substrate, from any determination.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's
substrate. And that's a really hugely ballsy thing to say, but it's also a huge argument for the book, I think, about formal cause laws.
Yeah.
You know?
Either it's just mathematics or it's formal cause laws. I mean, take out what Kavanagh says.
Yeah.
What kind of a law is that?
Right.
It's independent of the stuff. It could be an economy, it could be an autocratic set of proteins, or whatever.
Right, right.
So I don't know whether you say that's a mathematics, just some mathematics, or if it's a law, but it sounds like it's a law.
Yeah.
If statistical mechanics is a law, so is this.
Right, right.
Actually, statistical mechanics is independent of the stuff, too, right?
Yeah. Okay, so what I'm hearing is that this might be a good seed that I could use as the case study for the chapter.
I think it's great.
Yeah.
Well, I think, I mean, what I always like about your work is that you always try to make genes more interesting than they ever are than in molecular biology, right? I mean, you know, he's the gene guy. You know, where everybody is talking about epigenetics or, you know, wider environmental coordinations and so forth, Philip is always talking about the gene and how interesting the gene is. That's why I think it's so interesting. And we've had this conversation before about how interesting classical genetics is.
Yeah.
Classical genetics is a very creative period.
Can I say something about classical genetics?
Yes, please.
It's actually fucking brilliant.
It's beautiful.
Excuse me. computer, I mean recording device.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I used the word, whatever I used.
It's a good word.
Think of how genetics works. You take a fruit fly, mm-hmm. it turns out it has, I don't know, 16,000 genes. You didn't know that.
Yeah.
All you know is you can reach in, or mucking up genes can happen. They're called mutations.
Yeah.
And then you see some aberrant phenotype. What you're doing is you're reaching into a very complex system and you're smashing something. There's only a finite number of things to smash, 16,000.
Mm-hmm.
And you're looking at the consequences. It's a very interesting kind of experiment.
Yeah.
You have this sample space of 16,000 things, and you just bang away at it, and you see what happens.
Oh, absolutely.
And then you run into the following difficulty, which was pointed out by somebody years ago. If you have a radio, and you smash a tube in an old radio, and it starts to squeal, you're wrong if you think that the normal function of the tube is to suppress squeals.
Yeah.
Okay, and I can't remember, some famous psychologist said that about, you know, banging the part of your brain. And you're doing the same thing with mutants. And yet, people actually figure out what the wild type function of genes are. It's quite astonishing
how
it works.
To make your point too, I mean, I've been at so many conferences where scientists will talk about the history of genetics as we started off with transmission genetics and now we're getting epigenetics, and
mm-hmm.
that's not what's happening. There's this interesting undercurrent pulsing that gets pushed aside by certain times, like with molecular biology, some of it's with cybernetics discourse and mm-hmm. ideas of coding kind of pushes. But it is still such a rich, multi-determinative way of thinking about what's the relationship to development, that those histories are rarely recovered.
Yeah. That's great. Thanks. Thanks, man. Who wants to go next?
Shinwei and I are both going last, so.
I'll go penultimately.
Adam,
you want to go?
I could. I'm just gonna find it. I mean, I had a variety of things I could talk about. I'm actually looking through something, because actually it might be a nice follow-up to what you were talking about, because I have some sections on what I think are really interesting developments in classical genetics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it needs a little work, but I could sort of think about some of this. Hold on, I'm just trying to find it.
Well, here's Gaiman. Good timing.
Good.
Good. I don't even hear it. You listen to you about the beer.
What's good?
We're doing 15. Hey, we're doing 15 minutes.
Oh, you got it. Oh, hey, all right.
Hey. That looks promising in that black bag.
Reinforcements have arrived.
Are we doing the 15-minute go around?
Yeah.
We're doing 15 minutes.
Philip just went.
That series on Red Bull TV, and it's almost all about climbing and mountaineering.
Well, the climbing conversation.
But there's the important stuff, of course. But there's a thing on the Fitz Traverse they did in South America, but there's also just a thing on Alex Honnold, and there's a thing on that like 11-year-old Asian American kid who grew up climbing in gyms and climbs like horizontal roofs backwards.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's absolutely crazy. I mean, even
she's like, gonna like go hurt her. I mean, you know.
Best climbers in the world just look at her like, what?
Yeah.
You know?
That's just crazy.
She may even be younger. She may actually be younger than that.
Wow.
It's like, I don't know, it freaks me out a little bit. No, really, you know, it's like,
yeah.
When I see that in Cirque du Soleil or something, I'm fine with it. But now just to know that, you know, that
somebody really does it.
Yeah, that's just, that's crazy. Plus, what are her parents doing? It's like, no, if I were her dad, I'd be like, no, stop climbing the build. No, stay
down. And he has some sort of like, he's like some avant-garde dancer or something. Yeah, so he's kind of in the mix already.
Yeah, it has to be something like that. Ugh, I'd be so nervous all the time. Plus, what happens when the kid hits puberty? See, then everything gets screwed up. All her normal sense of balance and all that stuff, it goes away because your body's...
It's true,
you know,
yes.
So
it's true.
She better enjoy it while she can.
Because pretty soon she'll be a teenager.
Yeah, and it's not going to work
and
anymore.
And she'll go into a rebellion.
Exactly. She'll turn into like some sort of a supervillain, cat burglar type thing. That's how it always ends up. That's how these things always turn out.
You got what you're going to do then?
Yeah, I think so. Sorry, I'm just trying to... I'm not going to read a whole bunch of it, but I will sort of... Just because you were talking about genetics, and I think it might resonate in particular kinds of ways. So one thing I was going to say, that this would not be what I would put in the issue. Which is not what I would put in the issue. This is part of... another project, but what I would be putting in the issue would be something I would be developing more succinctly, the ways in which what I talked about last time in terms of the unprestatable conditions and the way in which that comes out of, or some of the stuff that you're working on, Stu, can be brought together in conversation with the stuff that Giuseppe Longo is working on in terms of moving beyond the phase spaces that are used in physics and talking about them in the biological realm.
Right.
But I really want to unpack this idea that I suggested last time, which is this idea of a transcendental biology and how it is that, and this is something I'm also getting from Giuseppe's work when he talks about the transcendental conditions within physics and phase-based construction, and how it is that might, what a non-prestatable phase space, how that plays out in terms of generating wider conditions for the emergence of novelty in the biological world, and how that helps, and that sort of plays out in a particular tradition of French philosophy, especially one that is closely aligned with people like Gilles Deleuze and their rethinking of the Kantian transcendental and how that actually might help us leverage a new way of talking about the transcendental in biology. So that would be the paper. I think that would be the paper I would contribute.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
But sort of playing off of Philip was talking about
being in love with fruit flies. That's what I was talking about.
I didn't hear it, but I could sense it.
You were for a long time. As you drove up, you felt it. A
little cruise.
Yeah, this comes. I'm just going to read probably about 5 or 6 pages of a chapter that comes in the midst of a conversation about the development of microscopy in the life sciences, and actually I'm talking about Fleming's work, and it sort of moves into a conversation of. About classical genetics. So, starting up in the middle here, despite the convergence of many experimental efforts on the chromosome and the emerging consensus that this stainable material, as Fleming called it, was the site of life's developmental and hereditary operations, was also the source of deep epistemological frustration. It functioned like a gatekeeper, this is the chromosome, to a molecular world that would remain impervious to empirical observation for the next half century. The chromosome was a promise that a material answer to the structure and function of life would one day be available. So while these nuclear contents were thought to hold incredible explanatory power, the material responsible for the chromosomal activity was beyond the scope of observation. It is as if the chromosome was drowned in space, one side turned toward human perception, signifying that an answer to many scientific questions about life was possible, and on the other hand turned toward its molecular workings that refused to answer the demands of human perception. What's remarkable about the era of experimental biology that spanned the late 19th century and mid-20th centuries is that it gave a wealth of determination to the unobservable conditions of cellular and nuclear activity. What was beyond the seeable and knowable did not go without structure and determination. And this structured excess, I'm calling it structured excess, had a name, the gene. Following a number of historians of biology, and I'm not going to name them all right now, there is an era, the era known as classical genetics, which followed the rediscovery of Gregor Mendel's laws around 1900, was not one thing or set of ideas. Instead, it was marked by conceptual ambivalences and by research practices that changed continuously, and is therefore better understood as a loose ensemble of research strategies and technologies that help to forge a disciplinary identity. And what follows... And what follows, I will make the argument that these ambivalences and uncertainties are crucial. What the gene was for classical genetics was constantly under negotiation. The gene was not one thing investigated using one set of techniques. Rather, the gene was multiple, capable of taking on many different meanings, resonances, instantiations, depending upon the experimental practice in which it was situated. But for all these ambivalences and divergent strategies, some of which I will recount here, the gene remained an abstraction that was irreducible to the observable features in the cell. Despite this, I contend that the gene was also what gave sense and meaning to those observable characteristics. In the following section, I draw on some key figures from this era of classical genetics, especially Wilhelm Johannson, Karl Korens, and T.H. Morgan. I use them as key touchstones for understanding what the gene meant to geneticists in the early 20th century. And while classical genetics is firmly anchored in the history of science canon, I want to suggest that the epistemological and ontological space opened up by classical genetic research lends itself to being read through a new philosophical lens. And here I draw on the sort of optics of Gilles Deleuze here. Sort of strange twist, but... without discounting the limitations of placing an alien theoretical frame on a diverse ensemble of scientific practices, I also don't want to overlook the utility of philosophical concepts for unearthing what goes unseen in them. And this utility will be brought into sharp focus in the era of classical genetics. I'm looking at Müller-Willi and Weinberger's work, and they note that the notion of the gene that surfaced after the rediscovery of Mendel's laws were adaptations and not direct translations of Mendel's original experiments published in 1866, and this is key. Mendel was an Augustinian monk who conducted hybridization experiments with peas and proposed that heredity was discontinuous instead of continuous. Availing himself of sophisticated statistical analysis, Mendel discovered that certain traits were dominant and others were recessive due to the distribution of heredity units or factors that would later be called genes, which could be predicted. These experiments led Mendel to publish his Mendel's Laws of Inheritance, Segregation, Independence, and Dominance. Okay. It is crucial to keep in mind that although Mendel's laws are thought to be foundational for classical genetics, they were reinterpreted as epistemic objects good for the study of heredity generally, instead of restricted to the narrow domain in which they were applied. When Mendel published the results of his experiments with peas, he saw them as a special law that applied to hybrids only. But when Hugo de Vries, Karl Korens, and rediscovered them in 1900, the time was ripe for them to be taken as general laws. Whatever the situation that may have led to their re/misinterpretation, Mendelian factors constituted a new knowledge regime of heredity that spread quickly throughout Germany, Scandinavia, Great Britain, and North America between 1900 and 1910. What the contents of this knowledge regime were remains somewhat unclear, however. Or in any case, what the gene was, where it was located, and what it did lacked empirical verification. This is why the gene is such fertile ground for us. It was a hypothetical entity, a fiction even, that was an organizing principle for research and experimentation instead of an empirically verifiable thing. We can see this abstract view of the gene in the post-Mendelian experience of Danish botanist Willem Johansson. In the annals of life sciences, Johansson is remembered best for coining the genotype-phenotype distinction in 1909, which had a tremendous impact on 20th century genetics. Although genotype and phenotype are idealized notions, which separate genetic and developmental spaces in a way that is perhaps no longer tenable in life sciences, Johansson's thesis was generated out of the constraint of his experiments on pure plant and animal lines. In particular, Johansson designed pure line breeding experiments on the princess bean, and I'm not going to pronounce the name, and barley. Johansson raised self-fertilizing plants and studied the characteristics of each generation of seed. Based on the observed characteristics of different generations of seeds, their physical dimensions, etc., he was able to place the pure lines into groups. Availing himself of statistical analysis, he then discovered that these groups were better determinants of the characteristics of a seed, were better determinants of the characteristics a seed would produce than the characteristics of the mother. What this meant is that there had to be some grouping or type which was distinct from what was assumed to be the hereditable characteristics that organisms transmit to their offspring. By 1905, Johansson called this type the genotype, which was the organism's hereditary information, and distinguished it from the phenotype, which indexed the actual observed characteristics of the organism. According to Johansson, the genotype hypothesis disproved the transmission theory of heredity. Where the latter theory postulated that patterns transmitted their characteristics to offspring, the former asserted that the qualities of both the ancestor and descendant are in quite the same manner determined by the nature of the sexual substances, or the gametes, from which they had developed. Based on these experiments with pure lines, Johansson concluded that the genotype was the sum total of all genes in the gamete or the zygote, and that the genotype did not evolve or change, but it was ahistorical. Indeed, the personal qualities of any individual organism did not at all cause the qualities of the offspring. For this reason, Johansson's genotype is closer to an atom or a molecule than it is to a living substance, though Johansson refused to assign a chemical makeup to it. In fact, he even claimed, and this is a quote from Johansson, that as to the nature of genes, it is as yet of no value to propose any hypothesis, end quote. In short, genes are not empirically verifiable, they have no observational basis, and so they do not have a chemical makeup. He even resisted Mendelian segregation into individual genes. Instead, the genotype is an abstract organizing principle that gives sense and meaning to the narrow confines of experimentation on pure lines. What was left outside of the purview of Johansson's experiments, however, was hybridization. And this is when I go into Carl Correns after that. And Correns, his subsequent development of dispositions. I'm going to sort of fast forward here, because I know I'm taking up quite a bit of time. And then I could talk about Morgan. So here's where I pick up. But if Johansson and Correns were both generally skeptical of identifying the actual constitution of hereditary dispositions, then the eminent embryologist and geneticist Thomas Hunt Morgan pushed what we could say and know about genes without actually observing them to their epistemological what we could say about genes to their epistemological limits. Unlike Correns, who worked with numerous plant species at once, Morgan famously conducted large-scale breeding experiments at Columbia University with a model organism, the fruit fly. Working in the famous fly room at Columbia University from the early 1910s through the late 1920s, Morgan and his group experimented on the mutants of the fruit fly to generate maps of its genotype, genetic maps. The major breakthrough came when Morgan and his group discovered that genes could be linearly grouped in particular locations on the chromosome, like beads on a string, which proved the so-called chromosomal theory of inheritance. Crucially, Morgan and his group were able to study the relative position of genes on chromosomes based upon the frequency of genetic recombination. He asserted that the frequency of genetic recombination, essentially that paired chromosomes could cross over to exchange genetic information, was somehow linked to the distance of genes on a chromosome. What he found was that the closer two genes were to one another on a chromosome, the more likely it was that they would be inherited together. Genes that are farther apart are more likely to split up during recombination. Genetic linkage, therefore, depends upon the relative distance genes share to one another on the chromosome. Thus, genes are spatial and recombinable units that have a determinable location.
What's Can I throw in one piece here? Well, the stunning thing is that you can take a pair of genes and you can define a distance between them by how recombination separates them.
Yeah.
So you can take a set of genes, and for every pair of genes, you can do the same thing.
That's amazing. Yeah.
What's amazing is that for each pair of genes, it turns out that they fall into a number of linkage groups equal to the number of chromosomes, and that it falls on a one-dimensional map.
Wow.
That's, it could have been two-dimensional or one and a half dimension.
That's it.
So that's what makes it beads on a string.
All right, I'm gonna add that.
Write that down.
I am, right now. Thank you.
Just
and that produces a lot of really fascinating anomalies later on we can discuss too. That a lot of that generated like some of what Barbara McClintock does and then Ed Bliss does with pseudo-allelism.
Yeah. Okay, thank you for that. Yeah. What's remarkable about Morgan's experimental program is that even though it enabled scientists to isolate the gene's relative location and thus spatialize heredity in a way that it had never been achieved before, it was still unable to yield the gene's material constitution. The physiochemical gene was still invisible and thus, strictly speaking, well, unknown, sort of. I mean, that needs to be worked out. And so it could only be studied indirectly through traits. However, Morgan and his group knew, for instance, that more than one gene was often responsible for a given trait and vice versa, which is why they resisted the idea of a one-to-one relation between gene and trait. Instead, they proposed a differential notion of the gene, which essentially meant that they studied the change in gene-trait relationships instead of, gene-trait relations instead of either one in isolation from the other. But even with this differential system in place, which generated tremendous insight into gene frequencies, the gene itself remained beyond the threshold of what we might say the visible and the knowable. But I'm not sure about that yet.
Framing it as differential is actually really useful.
Yeah.
And connecting is a lot of the different papers here.
I think that's right. In Morgan's 1933 Nobel acceptance speech, he noted that, and this is a quote, at the level at which the genetic experiments lie, it did not make the slightest difference whether the gene is a hypothetical unit or whether the gene is a material particle, end quote. In other words, the gene abstraction had real experimental effects instead of an empirically verifiable reality, and that's what mattered. Subsequent researchers, including Morgan's student, Herman J. Mueller, became convinced that they could hunt down the physicochemical gene. Of particular note were his experiments with X-rays that induced Mendelian mutations in Drosophila. But even with these experiments in hand, which seemed to suggest that a gene had a chemical makeup that could be altered through radiation, Mueller admitted in 1950 that, quote, and this is a quote, the real core of the gene theory still appears to lie in the deep unknown. That is, we have as yet no actual knowledge of the mechanism underlying the unique property which makes a gene a gene. Its ability to cause the synthesis of another structure like itself, in which even the mutations of the original gene are copied, we do not know such things yet in chemistry. It's end quote. My interest in Johansson, Correns, Morgan, and others stems from how they each generated distinctive gene theories from out of the specific demands of their experimental programs. What this means is that I'm less interested, actually, in how they may have revolutionized genetics research or exhausted any particular set of experimental practices. For instance, there are many other scientists who have far more accurate, quote-unquote, there's my phone, just let that go, accurate characterizations of the gene.
Time's up.
All right, hold on. I'm getting to the end here, hold on.
super groovy ringer. For instance, there were many other scientists who had far more accurate characterizations of the gene. Cryogenetic research in the 1920s and 1930s was able to flesh out gene position in a way that, in many ways, Morgan's work could not yet. But the accuracy of the gene concepts is not the point. That's not what I'm really interested in. I'm more interested in how the gene became a remarkably effective research tool, despite having no visible or physicochemical reality. But it is precisely because the gene lacked this reality, quote unquote, that it could take on so many different meanings, resonances, and functions. It was a multiplicity, irreducible to an empirically verifiable entity with the power to disqualify claims about it. This is why Johansson was able to maintain, even with Morgan's fruit fly experiments in hand in 1923, that genes were not separable things, pace Morgan, that Sutton and Boveri's chromosome theory was dubious, and that Sutton and Boveri's chromosome theory was dubious. What's equally significant is that the many different meanings attributed to the gene were determined by the experimental circumstances that they were entrusted to give sense and meaning to them. So for example, Johansson's genotype and phenotype distinction gave intelligibility to the fact that groupings of characteristics were stronger determinants of inheritance than the observed traits of patents. The genotype gave meaning to the phenotypic tendencies Johansson observed in his pure line experiments. And I go on and on and on. But essentially what I'm trying to unpack is this idea that the gene, it was a functional concept, and it actually traced this sort of, I guess you could say this sort of epistemological field, and it was incredibly generative.
Yeah.
Without actually being able to say what it was. Yeah. And it was by no means a mechanistic thing, and it was,
Well, that was, Shinwei and I were nodding that you read one passage that was the core of the whole paper that essentially, says it's like, we don't know what it is, but we know from its effects in experimental situations what we can and can't do and can't learn, even though we don't have a representation of it.
So the longer reading of this is actually, I hook it into a more sort of Deleuzian conversation about how the gene is actually a kind of multiplicity in this way.
Right. Right.
And well, I thought that's terrific, and I've actually been a geneticist for 10 years, so I know much of this stuff. I'd love that. I'd like to, may I just tell you some stuff that you might find interesting. I think there's a deep parallel between atomism and chemistry and the foundations of genetics. There's a guy named Ersch Strathmari, whose name you should know. Ersch is an old friend. Ersch wrote a major book with John Maynard Smith called The Major Transitions in Biology. He and I had this a month and a half ago in Budapest, and we shared the story. We have exactly the same hypothesis about what was going on in Mendel's mind. So I'm going to tell you, it's a hypothesis, okay? But since Ersch and I have the same one, and he's a really good evolutionary biologist, I give it some credence. So here's Mendel. Mendeleev is around. Atomism is rife in the day, right? Notice that a lot of chemists were not convinced that atoms were real things, right? It's Einstein who convinces physicists that atoms are real things in 1905. So Ersch and I both think the following. Here's Mendel. He's thinking about heredity. Kids look like mom and they look like dad. There must be some basis to heredity.
Mm-hmm.
Atomism, so here Ersch and me, we thought that eventually it's the same thing. Atomism is rife, it's in the air. What if he thinks the following? I wonder if there are atoms of heredity. Then he thinks through the consequences. Well, mom and dad have different traits, and the offspring has some traits of mom and some traits of dad, roughly speaking. Okay, make it simple, mom and dad. There must be atoms of heredity that code for the different traits, or that make the different traits, not code for it, somehow create the different traits. But I look like mom and I look like dad, therefore I must have atoms from mom and I must have atoms from dad. But mom and dad had parents, so they must have atoms of heredity from their parents, and that goes back indefinitely many generations. I must be absolutely full of atoms of heredity from my great 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 grandparents all the way back in this exponential tree, right? Mm-hmm. Well, that's no good. I mean, as time goes on, I have infinitely many atoms of heredity.
Mm-hmm.
I must have some way of getting rid of half of the atoms of heredity, because I get some from mom and some from dad. I better get rid of half of the atoms of heredity at every generation. Well, the easiest thought then is that I have one atom from mom and one atom from dad, and at meiosis, you know, at making the sperm or making the egg, somehow or another, half of them are lost. Once you say that, you do Mendel's experiments. Okay, you go and say, well, can I see these atoms passing into progeny? Well, dominance and recessive is not obvious from that line of thought. Then he discovers dominance and recessive, and then he goes through, and you know, the Mendelian ratios. Red eye is wild type, and white eye is homozygous recessive. Therefore, if you take red eye, homozygous mom, and a white eye, homozygous dad, and you mate them, you'll get the F1 is red and white, but it'll be all red-eyed. But if you mate them, one quarter of the offspring will be white-eyed. Okay, and that's what he finds. Sweet peas. Except that his statistics is too clean. Do you know this? It's been concluded that he's cheated. His data is too close to three quarters and one quarter. He sort of couldn't have gotten that by chance, goes the argument. Therefore, either he or one of his technicians
Fisher's great criticism.
Yeah, that's right. It was Ronald Fisher's criticism. And that might be right. Anyway, what I like about this is that Ursh and I both come to the same view that how the whole thing got started, but then it becomes the functional idea of the gene, is atoms of factors of heredity behave discretely and anatomically. And I think there's a reasonable chance that Ursh and I are right. Obviously,
yeah. And it's also really fascinating too, because so there's a couple cattle points to this, I think, that really solidify your argument too. First of all, it's Bateson, and why the chromosome theory people hated Bateson, Gregory Bateson's father, William Bateson, was because he's trying to come up with a wave theory of heredity.
Yeah, I remember you talking about that.
And development. But then the other thing is that's really cool is that once they've reduced that down to the one-dimensional space, and they come up with a lot of really interesting anomalies, like genes, because one of Mendel's laws is independent assortment. And first of all, you can't have totally independent assortment, otherwise you wouldn't have linkage groups. Mm-hmm. But then they're also finding these genes that are right next to each other that kind of seem to help each other. Right? And these are the experiments that then lead to thinking about genetic expression through Ed Lewis's work.
Yeah, regulatory gene networks.
It's
elegant history. Thank you.
It opens up a lot in contemporary work. So, you know, I work with these guys who make stuff. It seems to me, make stuff with biology. Seems to me a couple of things that are quite powerful about what you're suggesting here, or the way in which you're sort of systematically spelling out. First is, I don't think that's changed. Mm-hmm. I think that, in fact, the gene is still a kind of conceptual multiplicity that doesn't need to have a kind of material basis. But I think there's a twist on that, which is, I think since the genome projects in particular, genome sequencing projects, there has been the assumption that the question of what is a gene in its physiochemical dimensions has been answered.
Right.
But in fact, it just got skipped over in favor of it's an open reading frame or something. Mm-hmm. Okay. But the knock-lib and the afterlife of the belief that question has been settled physiologically has allowed bioengineers to now do these deep ontologies of the gene. Right. And they use the deep ontologies of the gene and the functional characterization of those deep ontologies to build tools that they think will allow them to manipulate living systems at a genetic level and even design them. And the cultural memory that we know what a gene is, even though we don't know what a gene is in terms of its physiochemistry, I mean, labs, of course, have in practice approximations of all of this. I mean, it's not hand-waving or something. You know, we treat X as a gene. But nothing really hangs on that. Like, you don't need this gene, you just need to be able to refer to it when you're in lab meetings or something. Whereas with these guys who are doing design work, they actually need the ontology to sit still. They need to know what the ribosome binding site is.
Right.
And they need to know that you can have that class in your relational database.
It's the only way you can have a bioengineer.
This other conversations we've had, quite powerful conversations around the tendency to treat living things as algorithmic things, to treat them as pre-stateable, is bound up in the ability to read a gene as a set of interactive components that make up the gene that can be physiologically made physiologically discrete and therefore abstracted both within a database, but then the database itself, of course, is regulated by the logical parameters of relational databases. This is a much longer conversation. But then the idea that you can build a whole set of machineries that can operate on those topologies and do the design work for you in a certain kind of way, or at least help you bootstrap the design work, all indexes back in a certain kind of way to the belief that out of the genome project you have genes.
Then let me just ask you, so what's happening then? Because with synthetic biology being a big deal, and biomimicry and biodesign being a big deal here at ASU, right? And elsewhere too.
Yeah.
What do you see happening? Because you see, these ontologies we know don't sit still. So these products get released into the wild. They go wild with unintended consequences. Yeah. Then we need to have much bigger stabilizing institutions like the Federal Reserve does with money supply, right? So what do you see happening now at the institutional level? There must be new kinds of lawsuits, class action lawsuits, you know what I mean? You know, regulatory agencies that don't exist but should exist. I mean, we don't see any institutions arising to
stabilize. There are very few new institutions, but this is because the old institutions believe operationally they can simply be adjusted to fit the new ontologies. Okay, so I can still do intellectual property with the existing intellectual property. So, I mean, if there was a place in which the gene concept got reified, it was an intellectual property.
Yeah.
You have to have a gene.
Yeah.
See, this is where the laws of the story will get, intersect with that story. It's very powerful.
And it's really powerful when you consider that once you start getting big dumps of money into biotech, even in these sort of invisible ways where, in the early 1990s, Big Pharma looks to the biologists to do chemistry better, or they think that there's a way in which they can be more efficient and all this. They only are going to invest in that if they think that they can lock down intellectual property, and the intellectual property isn't just about processes and tools; it's about objects.
Yeah.
This points out to maybe a way to go forward in tomorrow, next day, is to bring some people who are interested in this propertification processes. To make property out of things that are not really amenable to becoming property or shouldn't be. Like intellectual property for me for 20 years has been an oxymoron, right? And does that, and what you're pointing to very concretely, Gaiman's pointing concretely to how some of that's working in the bioengineering domain. To propertify certain entities.
Well, I mean, it's a really interesting way to start thinking about, I mean, quite literally we think about information capital and cognitive capital in a very different way, right? In a very abstract way, right? But you really wouldn't think about the gene as participating in this sort of regime of commodification in the same way, or in the same registers, right? What you're suggesting is that really, I mean, we have to make this this abstract thing called gene, right? We have to make it discrete. We have to make it commodifiable.
Yeah, and one of the ways in which you make it discrete if you're a synthetic biologist is keeping it as a reference point in the background that only gets gestured to. Yeah. It gets gestured to both as the warrant for the way in which you're providing physiological reifications of parts of the gene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's that. But there's also the political economy reference, which is, we want to make sure we can do an entire database of all the possible ribosome binding sites for this construct.
Right.
But we don't know whether or not we have freedom of operation because somebody might have a patent on the gene.
Yeah.
Well, this, and then the other thing that Gaiman said, I think, is really important. So it's not just about stability in space and time, it's also about the operational nature of the gene through the coding problem.
Yeah.
Right? It's the fact that this is a specific code that then you can treat in a certain way.
Right, exactly.
And that's the assumption. And that wasn't the assumption of the early exercises. And matter of fact, the early stuff by the coding people, and this is Horace Freeland Judson's point, was a failure.
Yeah.
It was a biochemist working pragmatically who did it, and the Locke operons, Jacobi Monod, that came out of a real phenomenologically into bacteriologists, who was interested in feedback loops and bacteriologists.
That's right, because they shifted from the metaphors of code to the metaphors of regulatory networks.
So that operationalization, that link between material and operation, ends up becoming a huge
problem. And the return to the language of code during the genome projects is actually a different reference to code than what you get earlier, I would argue.
It's also, in my view, I think I'm still sort of a relevant biologist, there's been a catastrophic mistake, not gene coding, I mean, the DNA code is the DNA code.
That's exactly right.
The notion that the organism, that the egg, or that the genome, contains a code for the adult, a master code, like a computer program,
is just wrong.
That's not what's happening at all, and it has misled us. For 50 years.
That's why the stuff.
Brian Goodwin first said this in, maybe 1982.
And this is, just look at the material ramifications of this. The bioengineering department at Stanford, just to pick one that I snoop around, is filled with people who now say they do RNA engineering. Why did you do RNA engineering? It's because I don't work on circuits, they'll say. I work on software. And, it's clever and it's communicable. But it also sets into motion a whole set of regimes about how you do work, who you train, who you attract.
I don't work on circuits, I work on software.
You can think of the machinery of the cell, the encoded machinery of the cell, as like the binary code that needs a program in order to do something.
As in a computer program.
As in a computer program.
And circuits would be what?
Basically the DNA.
What's so interesting about
it's hand waving, but it basically is that we don't engineer the DNA, we engineer the RNA.
Oh, okay, I see.
I mean, it's so funny. I mean, the way in which, synthetic biology has just reified all of this crap. I mean, the early days of biotechnology were far more experimental and interesting than what's happening with. At least the way you talk about.
This is my shtick lately in terms of. I don't want to shift this to me, I want to stay on order, but just to say that I think it's less that synthetic biology is a driver of all this stuff, and more that synthetic biology was the systematic articulation of a whole set of tacit imaginaries that were circulating in the early 2000s.
Might be the operational paper for me. Is then, because these types of histories tend to be very deterministic.
Right.
Like, code comes in, and it displaces this.
Right.
Right? When it's really, there's a whole set of issues out there that they're both working on and they're reaching towards how to build things back up again.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think that's a historiography issue as well.
There's this, to use insider jargon, there's a way in which with synthetic biology, people like Drew Endy, just to pick one of the characters in the mix, and there's of course dozens and dozens, they're like operating in a high-tech imaginary. Taylor's sense of all those presumptions that are operating at a tacit level allow us to build worlds together and inhabit them. And what he does is he brings that to articulation for a certain kind of biotechnical program, but the reason it's super successful is because he becomes a man of his time, that is to say, it's coherent to the other people who want to do this stuff.
Yep.
And so the reification of the kind of code, it's not just code language, it's the reification of a whole set of dispositions and practices around the making of digital technologies as adequate to the making of biotechnologies.
So can I bitch for a moment?
Yeah.
If you ask these guys, what's a cell type, they have no answer whatsoever.
Or if they haven't.
Jacob Monod did.
Yeah.
Jacob Monod said that a cell type is a stable pattern of gene expression. These guys don't think that. They don't think about it at all. They have no idea.
That's right.
And it pisses me off because
it's not stable.
I published a paper on it 50 years ago.
Yeah, but this is part of it is their inheritance of the huge data dump of genomics, which was the idea that at some fundamental level, all living processes are informational processes, and all informational processes are digital processes, and all digital processes can be captured in digital ontologies. And so, therefore, what makes one cell type significant to the engineering of some construct, ultimately will be shown to be non-fundamental, that is to say, that the motifs that they're operating with at the level of ribosome binding sites, to use their jargon, will allow you to create a basis set of informational motifs at the level of DNA, RNA, protein that will allow you to be agnostic about which form of life we're working with.
Right.
That all of life will be able to be reduced to informational motifs which can be mixed and matched.
Okay. Fantastic. We should probably move on.
Yeah.
Can I go next?
Absolutely.
Please. Okay, so I
need to get a little water.
Oh.
Well, I mean, you might bring me another class for me too.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys.
It's flowing very nicely.
Hey, Drew.
To the next.
What do you need? Do you need some?
No,
I'm
fine.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm fine.
I know it makes
my favorite time of year.
Too kidding. Well, the game goes fine.
What's that?
Too kidding.
Yeah,
description.
I'm a extractor. I'm pulling the minute. What's causal here?
What's causal? It's Gavin!
Apple.
Shut up, I'm tired of giving these letters.
Here goes, man.
Thank you.
Yep.
So I'm going to tell you guys about some work that's been underway for about 10 years, 2 years, 2 months, and 3 days. If you think about the diversity of the global economy of goods and services 50,000 years ago, perhaps there was 1,000 to 10,000 goods and services in it. There's 1 billion goods and services today in New York City alone. Ask the economists why, and they really don't have an answer. I'm going to try to broach an answer. I'm also going to try to talk about the evolution of the law, where almost certainly, if you look on the books, the number of statutes that Congress has passed, the total number of extant statutes almost certainly has exploded in diversity. I'm going to check that quite recently. And I want to try to present a model that allows us to talk about both things. The fundamental idea is that a good or a service, when it comes into a new good or service, creates a niche or an opportunity for still further goods and services to come into existence. And the same thing is true for laws. Laws create the conditions for new legal opinions, which wind up becoming new laws, which wind up creating new legal opinions, which wind up creating new laws. So I'm going to give a model that I think is, it's too simple, but it's kind of, it might be better than I think it is. But before we do, just think of the following history. In 1933, or whenever it was, Turing invented the Turing machine. Well, nobody knew, but that it did not cause, it enabled von Neumann to invent the mainframe computer, right? And then that was part of the coming into existence of the first computer, the ENIAC, during the war, and then von Neumann. So von Neumann, by inventing the mainframe computer, did not cause, but enabled IBM to start making mainframe computers, which then got sold. Well, getting sold created a market for computers, right? I remember it when I was using computers for the first time in 65 with IBM computers and DEC computers. The invention of the chip and the wide market created by IBM made it possible, did not cause it, made it possible to invent the personal computer, whose invention created a niche. It created a niche. It did not cause, it created a niche for word processing. And Microsoft came along, right? Mm-hmm. Microsoft and word processing meant that we had files on our computers, which afforded an opportunity to share files. And somebody invented the modem. Then the sharing of files did not cause, but it invited, it created a niche for the invention of the World Wide Web. Then the World Wide Web created the capacity to sell on the web, didn't cause it, it created the capacity to sell on the web, and eBay and Amazon came along, right? Then eBay and Amazon came along, and we were all on the web, and that put a lot of content on the web, and that enabled Google to come along, right? See how goods and services create niches for the next new goods and services that come along? Mm-hmm. The economists don't know this. I mean, I sort of promise you with some arrogance that they don't know. And one of the reasons they don't know it is the unpredictable uses of screwdrivers, unpredictability. They can't make a mathematical model of the specific things that will happen. So I've been thinking about that for years. And last summer in desperation, I wrote an equation. So I'm going to tell you what it says and then pass it around if you can read my writing. The idea is that new goods and services arise somehow from existing goods and services. So for example, the Gutenberg printing press is a recombination of a wine press and movable types. The airplane of Wright Brothers is a recombination of an airfoil, light gas engine, bicycle wheels, and a propeller, right? So the idea is that new goods and services arise by kind of combining old goods and services. That's not so much a new idea, I'm just trying to write down an idea for it. And it might be stateable or not pre-stateable. They may be new uses of screwdrivers in the way things get stuck together. They could be jury-rigging or not jury-rigging, which we can talk about. Anyway, here's the equation. I'll read it to you, then I'll pass it on. It says, the number of goods in the economy at time t plus 1, in a moment it's going to be the number of laws, same equation. The number of laws at time t plus 1, or the number of goods at time t plus 1, is equal to the number of goods around in the economy at time t, times some probability that new goods happen, where the probability then multiplies the following term. It's got all the possible goods, and you choose one of them, mt choose 1, plus all the possible pairs of new goods, mt choose 2, plus all of the triplets of good, mt choose 3, and so on, with different alphas in front of these chooses. So it could go up or down in some way, and I don't know. So here's the equation, just pass it around. So we started playing with this in the last 2 or 3 months with a friend called Jim Herring. And the equation does something really neat. There's only two parameters in the model, the initial m, the number of goods in the economy, and what this probability is. It's the probability that a new good arises out of old goods, singly or in some combination. And what happens is really interesting. From your perspective, so up on the wall, time is running this way. So time gets off to the right. And the curve creaks up very, very slowly, then all of a sudden it swoops up very steeply. It's got a hockey stick. Okay? I thought, that's really neat. So we're now exploring the NP, the MP plane. And basically, there's a trade-off between M and P and so on. But you always get a hockey stick for some value of M and P, initial M and P. The hockey stick is generic to it. So here's another thing you can do after you, suppose now you've generated a whole bunch of goods or a whole bunch of laws. Doesn't matter for the model, I just changed the name. Somewhere in the middle of the process, ask for each good, tell me who all of your descendant goods are. Who are you a participant in forming, directly or indirectly? Yeah. So imagine the descendant graph from each good. So here's a good, and it gave rise to this. Good A gave rise to goods B, D, and L, which gave rise to blah-de-blah-de-blah. You've got some. So if you guys don't know, it's what's called a directly cyclic graph. Between any pair of goods, there either is not or there is some arrow. If there's an arrow, it means that the guy at the end of the arrow, the head of the arrow, is the descendant of the guy at the base of the arrow. But there's no cycles in the graph, right? So it's called a directed acyclic graph. So we've begun to look at that. And it's power law distributed, which is, I'm 90% sure of this. So there's caveats around everything, I'm saying it's new work. Which means that if you plot for any particular node, how many descendants do you have? Most things have only a few descendants, and a few things have a hell of a lot of descendants. And if you plot log number of descendants on one axis, log the number with that number of descendants, you get a straight line down to the right. Mm-hmm. We're pretty sure, not quite, but assume right now that it's true, and I'll know more within a week or 2 or 3 weeks. Suppose that it's true. Okay, now let's turn to real life. The average wealth per person stayed constant. I'm going to tell you something that's true, but I'm going to be out of the field where I know what I'm talking about, and speculating from what I've heard from others. The wealth per person stayed constant from the Roman Empire to through the Middle Ages to 1830, and then it took off, right? Well, we think of it as the Industrial Revolution. The question is why did it take off? Okay? And so it's a hockey stick. Well, here's the model that gives a hockey stick. But then that raises some very interesting questions. Why didn't the Chinese get a hockey stick? They were on the verge of an industrial revolution in 800. Then it never happened. Why didn't it happen in the Roman Empire? It was around for 800 years. Why wasn't there a big hockey stick in Roman times? So there's some putative answers to all of this. One of them is there's a difference between muscle power and steam power. That steam power breaks you free from having to have slaves, and that may be part of it. Another part of it, which I find more interesting as a non-historian, is the claim that in agrarian societies, the lords confiscate any innovation that the serfs happen to make because they don't want to upset the order. They want to keep it stable with themselves on top, and the serfs are squashed down. That something happened in England and Holland in around 1800 or 1830. Somehow society changed. I've been learning this in the last weeks, and it became in Holland and in England, it became worthwhile to reward innovation per se, in part because companies got invented. Mm-hmm. And companies want to go out and innovate and invade new markets. So the invention of companies may have had something to do with the idea, the way to get rich now is we've got steam power, we can have mobile rotary power everywhere we want. This is something that my friend Maurice Hulot Flores told me 5 days ago. It's not, I'm quoting others. And that the invention of corporations bespoke the need for innovation to invade new markets and invade new goods and new services. So that may have done it. So maybe that's that combination of things. Maybe steam power and maybe the invention of corporations and maybe the passage from an agrarian society to a mercantile society to a post-mercantile society had a lot to do. This is you guys, it's not mine. Given that, then I want to try to explain the hockey stick. Okay? Now, and I'm going to get to the law in a moment. Can one hope to find out that for any good or service, the number of its descendants is power law distributed? The answer is yeah, maybe we could actually find out. And in particular, if you look at patents, every patent cites all its prior patents, mm-hmm. right? Therefore, I can look at a patent and I can find out who its descendant patents are. So the corpus of patents is a background that could be studied to look at the descent distribution of inventions, and that might be completely doable. And let's suppose that we truly do find a power law, and let's suppose that power law has a particular slope in a log plot, whatever it is. Let me say it's 1.5, but minus 1.5, I don't know what it is. I'm not even sure it's a power law, but I bet it is. Then we find out that that's true. That's pretty neat. That's some mixture of whatever. So this is trying to give a model for why the economic diversity explodes. Roger Koppel, who's an economist friend of mine, is more enthusiastic about this than I would have thought. He thinks this could really be important. I don't know if it is. So now let me turn to the law. So
you're arguing that there's a change in ownership.
This is outside.
You're going from real property into
something happened in Holland and England that I don't know about, but you guys probably do. It changed things in some way that permitted innovation to be important, be honored, and earn a return.
Okay,
so in the law, it's the same argument. So let's think about the law. So we have conceived of a paper 3 days ago, 2 days ago, whenever it was, Sunday. What's the day? No, Saturday.
It is Monday.
So Saturday. Karen and I were sitting around in Santa Fe, and we wrote an outline for a paper. We just took notes for 5 pages of notes. And we started thinking, well, what's going on in the law? Some law gets passed, and law clerks write opinions like mad. Then those opinions may become new laws, or the opinions give rise to yet further opinions, which then give rise to further opinions, which then wind up changing the law, so the new law gets passed, and the whole thing keeps going. So every law every opinion has descendant distribution. It's the same issue. And in the law, there is something huge called stare decisis. Stare decisis means let it stand, for God's sakes. Quit fucking around with it. Stare decisis. Stare decisis is the pull towards conservatism in the law that says, honor the reasonable opinions of your predecessors. And it's precedent, after all.
Right.
Precedent is stare decisis. Okay? And then precedence changes and so on and so forth. But there's an opposing tendency for which, interestingly enough, there's no term in the law. It's legal novelty. It's people coming up with new opinions and new loopholes and so on. It's happening all the time. It's fascinating that there's no term for it that we can find in the law. There might be one, but there doesn't. So we've come up with a title, and I love the title. I'm partially responsible for it. It's stare decisis, legal novelties, and justice in the balance. Justice is precisely the balance between the creativity of the law into the diachronic becoming, which can't be restated, and stare decisis, which is don't go too fast, which we wind up summarizing, Karen and I, with amusement as don't fuck it up too bad. Okay? It's kind of what's going on. So if this works, what we're going to do is, Karen has looked at a case, there's something called Johnson, which is some big case, and I don't remember what it's about, but she wrote a whole paper on it, and she's got all of the descendants of the original Supreme Court decision. She's got a whole bunch of them. So she's going to look at that and do the directed acyclic graph of that particular case that she's looked at. And I hope that in the next year we write this paper, and Roger will be part of it, and we're going to write an economics paper as well, and Jim Harriet, because he's doing the simulations. And suppose that, and we're going to look at two things. We're going to look at the total number of statutes on the books and ask, is there a hockey stick? I bet there is. I mean, I don't think there's a gradual increase. I think if you look at the number of the statutes, are just going to blossom upward. That's going to look just like that, I bet. And there's something else called the Congressional Federal Repository of something or another. Anyway, it's all the regulations. And my bet is that if we look at the total number of regulations, it's going to show a hockey stick also over the last 100 and 150 years. So we're going to look at that. For all of those, we can find the descent distributions. Okay, they all every regulation has a descendant regulation. Not everyone, but lots of them do. So we can find out if it's a power law. So just suppose it all works, you guys. We will have written down this dumbass simple equation. Here's what's wrong with the equation, at least. It doesn't have any debt. Nothing dies in this equation. Goods come into existence, mm-hmm. Nothing ever dies. But I was talking to Roger about it. He said, don't worry. We'll just go ahead with this. And okay. So this may be the first model ever written down that just says new goods and services arise by helter-skelter, hook and crook, jury-rigging somehow out of existing goods and services. Same thing for laws. It makes no claim about the specific law, mm-hmm. consistent with the screwdriver argument, okay? I'm worried about P. I'm imagining that I can write down a probability that a given good or service will give rise to another good or services. I'm not sure that I can write down a probability. That's like measuring the dimensionality of the adjacent right. possible. I'm not sure you can do that at all. But at least if you do write it down, by hook or by crook, you get a hockey stick, and it's testable. So to sort of summarize this, this is the first time I really had to talk about it, we may be able to predict the shape of the hockey stick, okay, how it increases in time. It may apply to the economy, it may apply to laws, it may apply to regulations. If it does, there's something very general going on. It may be captured by this dumbass model. And not only can we predict the hockey stick, which is a zeroth order thing, just a line, okay? Mm-hmm. If we can predict that there's a power law distribution of descent distributions, then we can predict the slope. That's actually getting interesting. So that.
So lots of cool stuff that could be said in response to that. Or lots of cool stuff that evokes. And one of them is, it'd be quite interesting if you plot this, to think about the ways in which you can zoom in on your hockey stick and find sort of hockey sticks within the hockey stick.
Right.
And use this as a kind of device for looking in more depth using proper nouns about what's going on in the world. So it seems to me that
like, what do you mean?
Like, if you see some change in your slope,
Oh.
to just go, well, what's going on? This is...
Can I respond? I hear you. Can I respond to you? Yeah. Roger came back, it was 5 days ago, and said, what if your P can change in time?
Yeah.
Okay? So we're not going to do some runs in which P changes in time in the simplest proper way.
Yeah.
It's either what it is or zero.
Yeah.
So we're going to have a little probability, little p,
yeah,
per unit time,
yeah,
that big P becomes zero,
yeah,
and little probability Q that goes back to being whatever it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty obvious that if P is zero, nothing will happen. Namely, it'll change the slope, is what you just said. And if P goes back, it'll do whatever it's doing.
Yeah.
So obviously you could have big P.
So I'm thinking of just an example as we're talking. I was thinking about in the last 2 decades, the way in which the behemoth technology corporations in the Bay Area have sort of vacillated between a shift toward a kind of conservative relationship to innovation. The iPhone, Apple wants to produce things like the iPhone, but once they produce the iPhone, they don't want people to innovate because now they want to act like, you know, the clothing company Gap, where
right,
they produce a new product every 6 months and you throw away your old clothes and you buy a bunch of new clothes.
Right.
You know, so they don't want any sort of radical shifts.
Okay. So they don't want to innovate.
And yet then companies like Google realize that they see the life cycle of their own wealth generation and they realize that they've got to start investing in lots of other things to produce the equivalent of a smartphone at X date down the road if they want to continue their growth trajectory. And so you get these binds within the
yeah, that's right. Can I come back to you with something?
Yeah.
Let's go back before for a moment. Some time ago, you know, I've got this idea of the adjacent puzzle. We've all talked about it. And I've got this idea of subcritical and supercritical growth. Supercritical growth is you're just exploding. And so there's the question is there anything that gates our entry into the adjacent possible? Okay? Why don't we go faster and faster and faster and faster and faster to the adjacent possible? And economically, one answer is, if the rate of entry into the adjacent possible is so fast that the life cycle, the lifetime of a new good or service was too short to make a living on it, I've argued to myself for several years, we'd slow down.
Yeah.
And that's what you're just telling
yeah
me.
Yeah, and you need a certain durability to the niche in order for it to produce diversity and ramify out.
So you're saying that what's happening is it's spreading wider.
Yeah,
in other words, I've got you. So do I have you right? I can't innovate my own main product faster because I need 7 years to get my investment back on, or 1 year,
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, I'll invent something else off on the
that's
side.
That's right.
I'll
create a quasi-monopoly with regard
oh
to
oh, yeah, that's neat.
Yeah, so it has this... So it would be interesting to sort of plot whether or not these changes in essentially cultural practice around innovation are significant enough to change the rates and probabilities. That was just one. Let me just flag a second. I won't talk very much about it. But
so
it would be interesting to
just absorb it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so what you just said is, I think, I can't innovate on my main line fast enough because there's a lifetime for my product that must be around for me to make a profit on it. But I still want to innovate like mad to expand my market. Therefore, I better innovate off on the
yeah
side somewhere. And I wonder if I want to put that into an update on this model.
Yeah.
Kind of,
yeah.
You know.
Can I ask a question here? kind of a second order question. To what extent does the financialization of real goods and services make it exciting? Think about, okay, I'm innovating something. And the issue is the thing going to work or not? The issue is, can I make money on the financialization of the risk?
What do you mean by financialization of the risk?
Turn it into an investment vehicle so that it becomes purely abstract and it's not. Yeah, so
no,
I know it's going to
so
fail, I'm still going to
so
make
I'm
money
gonna,
on
I'm
going
to make a ton of money off people buying iPhones, but I'm also going to make shitload more off the growth in the stock price.
Well, and then also...
I mean, the 08 bubble is exhibited.
Well, and then also
course,
you get
right
people making money on failure.
Yeah,
right.
You
like
financialize
debt,
mortgages that you
right
know
yeah
are going to
right
fail. I mean, so
right
so innovation becomes something different under financialization.
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
Right.
But and this is what I meant by zooming in on the hockey stick. Could you see perturbations and then ask what's
right
going on
well
with regard to
and
real
you
world
also
practices?
Right, right.
I mean, what worries me, I mean, it's like super, super interesting. And what you're asking, though, is about historical specificity, right? Is that, you know, the rate's going to change depending on various...
Or does it? I mean, maybe it
doesn't.
Maybe it
doesn't. That would be interesting.
Can I suggest, because this connects
to all of this. And we've had this discussion about graph theory before. I don't think it's adequate to do what you want to do for this reason. Connects with what we talked about, how we define the global earlier too. Mm-hmm. I think your intuition about the idea that, well, this doesn't take into account failed products that are no longer, and you don't have any feedback mechanism with acyclic directed graphs. Graph theory, there's no way to which is definitely relevant in the type of dynamic you're talking about.
You can have a graph that's got cycles in it.
Yes, but that's not what you were describing.
Absolutely.
And it comes out in your description when you talked about the innovations involved in going from solid state, the invention of the ENIAC and Multivac and UNIVAC to word processing. You defined it in a nice, clean, graph theoretic way that works pretty well. But I think the reality of the way that evolution worked is a little different, which takes more into account what you brought up and what you brought up and what you brought up, which is this. What about the fact that everything you said is true, but there were a lot of technologies that were developed, intermediate technologies that were discarded as irrelevant. Almost everything that we know about modern computing and the internet doesn't come directly from that lineage you defined. You could make the argument that it actually comes from the photocopier, almost all of it, because all the innovations that drive modern computing came from PARC, from Xerox, Palo Alto Research Group. They didn't know what the fuck to build. They just said, hey, we have all this money from our copying empire. We don't even know if these technologies are gonna be viable. We just wanna put you guys in a room. You come up with something that might be viable, might not. One of those was the laser printer, which Xerox said, fuck it, we don't want it. It's not going to make us any money. Wrong. TCP/IP was developed there. The Internet Transfer Protocol was developed at PARC to network computers. The language that makes the modern internet possible is developed there at PARC. The graphical user interface developed at PARC. All those things are integral to why everybody's into modern computing today, because of all these innovations that came from PARC. And all of that involves feedback, all these crazy feedback loops, right? Yeah, that seem to me. So my feeling is, if we're gonna use the definition of global that we were talking about earlier, combined with your idea, what you'd end up with, instead of an acyclic directed graph, you'd end up with something that captures these weird overlaps that are cyclical to develop the whatever the global state is. You're talking about the global state of all the potentia that are viable, I suppose, economically today, that global state. You'd need something like category theory to represent that.
No, you wouldn't necessarily use category theory, not for this, but there are other things you might want to use before that point.
Or sheaf theory. Now, that's not the only way, but I'm thinking of it obviously in terms of physics. Yeah. The way that we would define a global state that involves these kind of feedback loops that involve these overlapping local contexts would be something like sheaf theory, because there is no directionality to it in that sense. Well, there is, but there's a feedback mechanism that's allowed, because the global state's constantly changing. You need a way of going back and showing how an irrelevant, an irrelevant product down back in the lineage all of a sudden becomes rehabilitated as relevant because of some new potential. So in other words, the potential don't go away, the potential stay.
I think that could be shown by this. I'll tell you, And I heard what you said, I think you're right. Let me tell you, but with this no-death thing, you guys know about Shepherdarian Gale, the creative destruction?
Yes.
So Brian Arthur taught me years ago, the automobile comes in, and it kills the horse as the main mode of transport. With the horse goes the buggy whip, the saddlery, the pony express. A whole bunch of things die out of the economy, and with the car, you get an oil industry, a gas industry, paved roads, traffic lights, traffic courts, fast food restaurants, motels, and so on. So that's a Shepherdarian Gale of creative destruction. But it killed the horse. Mm-hmm. That's not in this model. And that's what I wrote Roger about. I said, there's no death in the model. And he said, but for a start, don't worry about it.
There are some questions. So, for example, what is it? I think this is fantastic, but we don't have time to talk about it all today at the level it deserves. But let me just make a few bookmarks and come back to it another day. One of these serious issues is what constitutes an innovation. Another is what constitutes a product. So, for example, a lot of these effects are pointing to, yes, there are one class of effects, but another effect would be iTunes. And then another side effect of that side effect would be the possibilities for musical ensembles to try to make a practice, make a living
playing concerts again, not just selling LPs and CDs, but they don't exist anymore, but because of the rise of attention, larger fields of attention paid to these small ensembles. So can't you go out there and say, we're going to do a concert and have people come to that concert so they can, you know what I'm saying? Side effect. And these side effects are entirely different levels in ontology, which are not addressed by the single curve. Now, yes, there's innovation, but it's a whole different parts of ontology. Second point is, like Graeber, David Graeber wrote a very nice article, which is what, you know, what is it, something like, why don't we have, you know, flying machines and teleportation devices? Yes. That, I forget the long title it was. Is what happened to innovation?
In the bathroom, he wrote that.
Right, right.
Where's and then my also, flying car?
Flying car. Exactly. Okay, and Ken Work, and Ken Work 2 days ago, or was it yesterday? Ken Work 2 days ago said, you know, there is no innovation in Silicon Valley. And being part of that, I know what he said is the case. There was no innovation. Basically what happens, after a while, maybe when Anatole Holt was working, when he was first programmer for the first private non-ENIAC computer in Philadelphia in 1948 or whatever it was, there was innovation there. But when it, by the time it got to Silicon Valley, there was less and less and less innovation. So in fact, it's a repackaging of products which can happen. Okay, so the financialization question is very important. Because you can make money even in the absence of innovation, actually.
Well, this,
I'm going to put this on the table, and then we can talk about it another time. But I really put it on the table.
Right.
Now, China, for example, the Needham question comes up, right? The question about China. Actually, you know, if you think about it, you look at, let's say, literary practices in China after, let's say, 1948 to 1950 with the May 4 movement, Lu Xun, okay, this kind of thing. There's a tremendous amount of innovation in China, but it happened to be happening in the literary domain, in a popular fiction domain, not in technology. So the question is, by what metric are we talking about measuring innovation, right? So now, second, another point is that the exponentiality of the curve is nothing remarkable because as soon as we have, you know, like dp dt equals lambda p, we get exponentiality. So yes, I think as a first order theory, this is true, but it's true of all sorts of phenomena, including biological diversity. Another point, you know, we have this notion of punctuated equilibrium, right? We can have local exponentiality still punctuated, so that, you know this very well, still punctuated so that the global diversity does not increase monotonically with history.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to increase monotonically. You can have local increase without monotonic increase over all time. Right? So of course, I mean, of course. So the theory is true and also not true. I mean, it can be true or not true. It can be true at certain scale of time, not true. Another point, Soares, S-O-A-R-E-S, has a very interesting theory about, so in addition to products, we have to think about value of products. Because if we think about, this is a kind of an observational theory, but we would, if you are scientific, we'll also be interested in kind of like a, how do you say, how does it work kind of theory, right? Which gets to your proper nouns. Game of proper nouns. So I read it this way. In terms of proper nouns, say, well, what are the actors? What are the agents? And also, what are the aspirations, desires, and what are the forces at work that make these things change?
Yeah.
Okay. So in that domain, there's a huge amount of theories to apply. Even if we stay within economics, this notion of value and price.
Yeah.
So going back to Schraffa's famous theory of price, or going to more forward to about 10, 15 years ago, the famous theorem by Soares, S-O-A-R-E-S, who proved the theorem, said that any economy with at least three products and three consumers, its prices will go generically to infinity or minus infinity. This is a fundamental theorem. So it'd be interesting to have, okay, in addition to this, have on top of it a theory of price, which tells us a little bit about what drives things. This is a forward reference to Nicholas Demetis, who's actually here in town. I hope we can talk to, I actually started talking to Nicholas at dinner last night about this thing. So he can probably speak more to it than I can. But putting price as a way to mark desire, then we're into open waters, deep waters.
Yes.
Yeah, it's interesting.
So in the history, intellectual history of political economy, the problem is that this particular figure has been overshadowed by Marx, but what you're suggesting is, what I've been hearing suggested here is much better explained by Thorstein Veblen.
Yeah, Veblen's all over this.
Yeah, he's so over this, because he's got an emulative theory of price and the theory of the leisure class. Right, so where things become expensive precisely because high social class people start to use them, and then but things don't die in that same way. They become transformed into different functions. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, horses are no longer used to plow fields; they're used
for
dressage.
Right.
And then he talks about the change in the business enterprise with the theory of the business enterprise, and the move from industrialization to the notion of speculation in the theory of business. Mm-hmm. So I think he could be a key intellectual historical figure for that.
And I do think with Veblen, just in terms of intellectual style, there's a really nice sort of bootstrapping rhythm between, if you will, theories and models and historiography and some sort of quasi-ethnography in which, like, his theory of like training capacities, what happens to people when they begin to work in different sorts of workspaces? They learn not to be able to do certain kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And that all begins with him with like this very close fine-grained study of what happens in certain kinds of factories, and then he bootstraps that to a theory, and it seems to me that this, you know, I don't know enough about the way in which the math works in order to know what's left out of a certain kind of equation. I mean, I hear what Michael's saying, and it totally makes intuitive sense. But there is a certain sense in which it seems that if models can be indicators, if we think that there's something about these realities that we're interested in that are non-prestatable,
yeah,
that are characterized by the dynamics implied by the inductive global, that systems are autopoietic in some sorts of ways that are connected to these other two variables, I mean, those sorts of things, like, yeah, we want an intellectual style. One of the things that's powerful about a model is that it just suggests some places where you might pay attention.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the question would be whether or not this gives you enough to see.
Yeah.
Right. Well, if we find, so sort of in defense of this, the group I was working on, there's only three of us or four. We call it the silly model because it's so silly. But maybe it's not. See, here's what, do you know competitive general equilibrium?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the fundamental theory in economics due to Aaron DeRue, published in 1954, something like that. And the problem they're trying to solve is the following. Given supply and demand, so I can say this in just a couple of minutes, but the main thing is that you've got a pre-stated set of goods and services. So you have to have a pre-stated set of goods and services. Then the question is there a vector of prices such that, given the consumers and their vector of demands, is there a vector of prices such that markets clear? The notion of equilibrium in economics has been that markets clear. That's the equilibrium notion, supply and demand balance. The problem is the following. You change the price of bread and you change the demand for bread. But what if you put butter on your bread and you change the supply of butter? What happens to the demand for bread? So once you've got more than one good, it's no longer so trivial, right? Because they're coupled to one another. So Aaron DeRue proved a theorem in 1954 showing, under rather general conditions, that in this model, which I could explain to you guys if you want, under very general conditions, you get equilibrium. There's a vector price such that all markets clear. And basically, you've got agents, and they've got probability distributions over what's going to happen in the future, which are the sets of expectations, they've got utility functions, and you've got a pre-stated set of goods and services, and then the economy unfolds in some stochastic way, and contracts come due or not, depending upon what happens, and everything works out. It's a gorgeous theorem. It's a fixed point theorem. But it can't talk about new goods and services coming into existence.
Yeah. Right.
And it certainly can't talk about the fact that the new goods and services coming into existence aren't pre-stateable.
Yeah,
and that's why the economists don't talk about it, because they want to write down equations.
Yeah.
And what's funny about this little equation is that you can't state what the goods and services are, but you can state how many of them you've got.
Yeah.
Well, that's actually something you could maybe study.
Well, I was going to just follow up with Shen Wei's set of observations, but also yours, Gavin. I mean, going back to this thing about models versus theories, I mean, one way to think about this is to step back and say, okay, a huge ideological and political problem that we live with right now is the confusion of the relationship between growth and innovation. That's a huge fucking problem.
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
And so this could be an invitation to step back and say, hang on a second, let's think about the difference, especially under financialized late capitalism, the difference of actual innovation and economic growth, quote unquote.
Yeah, you could have economic growth with the same set of goods and services.
Yeah.
I mean, just
goes back to his point about Ken Marx talk about.
Yeah, just consider you're Saudi Arabia and the demand for oil is going up and you got a lot of oil. The only thing you got is oil, but you're growing, right? Because the demand for your single product is going up. So you could without any
innovation,
right?
Yeah.
Hey, we should actually move on to make sure.
Do you think we should keep doing paper?
Oh, so here's the thing.
Is there some chance that you could solve this differently?
We want to do three more papers.
Well,
at this
it's exponential.
Yeah.
I'm going to send out a paper to this.
Too much. Man.
So we have a reservation tonight at 8:15.
I'm assuming, are you, is everybody coming?
I have to take off about 9.
Okay.
So I may like go for a little bit of dinner and then
you gonna leave those drinks again?
What's that?
I hope you leave those drinks again.
Yeah, totally.
So yeah, it's at the Fat Ox.
That's good.
Oh, cool.
Have you been there?
I haven't, but I wanted to.
Yeah, so at the Fat Ox, they have plenty
of
vegetarian.
Can we have a 2-minute break? Or can
I think we just did 3 papers. I don't think we should do 3 more. I'm, you know, at this, at 20 to 5, you know.
Maybe do a few papers tomorrow morning, too.
Yeah,
yeah.
Sure.
I mean, because we'll have the papers, but then we want
to
talk about
it. To go,
no, no,
but I got to go.
We can
do
tomorrow.
Yeah.
Have as many minutes as you need, baby.
Yeah, that sounds good, man.
That's
5 o'clock, so.
Bios is skiing.
Anyway, yeah, so
it also might, I mean, I'm just thinking, it might be nice to just kind of take in what we've been talking about and reflect on a little bit before we just kind of plow ahead, you know.
Yeah,
no,
that's good, man. Fat Ox was, you know, practical here. Modern Italian, the church.
That's
so,
okay.
That's good.
De facto.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, yeah.
That ties into legal standards
as
well.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's good little sash.
Maybe a lot.
Oh, look at sash.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. On a fly, but yeah, it's good. So funny, Philip, when you did yours, I'm like, huh, I got something I think I would pair nicely with.
That's cool.
Yeah.
This is exactly what this should have been doing, so that's really good.
Before we shift to drinks, I don't want to offer another paper, but I do want to just note that I'm teaching tomorrow morning. So if I could just like give the 5 minutes of what I'm working on, just so that it's like
out there, yeah.
Like out there.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I think we can handle one more, just not 4 more.
But I can't handle doing a whole substantive thing, but I would just like to sort of flag some things I'm working on that I can fit in.
Right.
And so, just, I'm working on more or less 3 different projects, although they interconnect. The first and the biggie is this stuff I talked about last time, is digital biology. And what I mean by digital biology, vaguely, is what are the ways in which biotechnologists today are thinking about computational technologies as affording a future of biotechnology that we cannot access without the machine. And what are the ways in which they're putting into place institutions, research practices, styles of reasoning, apparatus, computer apparatuses, etc., that comport with this jargon that I'm using around digital biology, which is a kind of, in places like Silicon Valley, a kind of widespread sensibility operating at a tacit level that says the logic of digital things is commensurate with the logic of living things. And that you can operate on living things by way of digital things in a way that doesn't, not only doesn't have a cost to it, but in fact is this amplifier. And so I'm interested in just assembling case studies of people who are trying to think, make, transform living things through digital things, by way of digital things. So one of the case studies is so-called knowledge commons, online knowledge commons, so the Gene Ontology Consortium. What's their history? Where did the ontologies come from? What do they think you can do with the ontologies? What are the sort of critical limitations of it? Why is it that 45 different alternative ontologies have sprung up at places like EBI and others?
Could you give one example of an ontology? Like
this gene
causes blue eyes is an ontology.
Yeah, or we have 10 subgroups to work on. This example's on my mind because it's what I was thinking earlier, is ribosome binding sites. And we have to define exactly what we mean by that term. And we have to define exactly how it is that people measure it and characterize it if they want to put stuff in our database. Okay, now we've nailed that down. But the idea with the Gene Ontology Consortium, as many of you know, is that there's a way in which you can take a functionalist, reductive snapshot of every element within a living system, a cell, more or less, and put it into a relational database. And that if you can get enough people to do this, ultimately the payoff is going to be that the fragmentary nature of biological knowledge can be stitched back together and you can have a total picture of the living thing.
It's always, if you have enough.
If you have enough.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's just one example.
Will you take a question, or should I shut up?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, you said a functional. It's the function.
That's right.
So the functional I heard is to pump blood.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So therefore, my regeneration database, I guess it would have hearts pump blood.
Yeah.
But my heart jiggles water in my pericardial sac, too.
Yeah.
That's not the function of the heart.
Yeah.
The function of something is typically a subset of its causal consequences.
Yeah. So
let's just say what the function is of some little thing that's wiggling somewhere.
They have
to put into the ration database.
If you go in, you can go in and see these decision trees in that come out of the conversations with the meetings of the gene ontology consortium. We say that this little bit of RNA does this. But we know that in order to do this, it has to have these relationships. In order to have these relationships, it has to have. And so they try to build out all the variables that parameterize this thing so that you can name it and get it to sit still.
Mm-hmm.
And they understand that on some level it's arbitrary, but what you need is just to make it machine readable.
Yeah.
And that's the point.
It works, sort of.
It works, sort of, but it's not clear whether or not it does. And it's not clear whether or not it does because the idea is that the logic of the relational database or the logic of algorithmic machines per se is adequate to this disaggregation of living things, the identification of characteristic features. You implant it in a machinery, and now the machinery can allow you to do something that you weren't able to do, even just at the level of work cycles in the lab.
Just because
it's too expensive, or it's too sloppy, it's too messy.
Just because you disperse.
Another question.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, wait, I just want to ask the question of how just because one disperses the loci of analysis doesn't mean the analysis is any less problematic.
Yeah.
Right? This is why it's the category 3 is premature. Is only as strong as the measurements are available.
I accept that the reason category theory works is because a relational database, the reason this doesn't work is because a relational database cannot capture how relations change relata.
That's right.
And so, that's why you need category theory, because category theory has a mechanism by which alter the relata themselves.
We'll take that outside.
Yeah, so
if you capture.
This is quite interesting in that, just ethnographically.
Yeah.
You go to the meetings of the Gene Ontology Consortium, super duper smart people, you know, scientists attending these meetings. They have a debate about, like, what are we going to call something? On some level, that's what he said. What do we call something such that I can compare the shit I'm doing with the shit you're doing? And it's searchable. One, it's searchable. Or if I want to build models, my computer can just, like, suck down stuff out of your database without me having to do it. You know, there's all sorts of reasons why someone might want something like the Go consortium database.
Yeah.
But then they have all of these debates with the techies.
Yeah.
And let alone with the curators.
Yeah.
Who have to clean it all up because nobody actually can conform to this. You know, so that somebody else, you hear people say, well, the problem is, like, the problem with all of this and the reason it's not reliable is, in the following ways it's not reliable, is because the logic that drives a relational database is out of date. Like, there are just better ways to do databases, per se.
Mm-hmm.
Or somebody will say, well, no, it's that there's not enough context information. You're stripping away too much context information.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put more context information back in. And the curators say, no, you put that much context information back in and you can't do, it's not comparable anymore.
Yeah.
Like, and so you can't put things within the same ontology bin.
Yeah.
And so I'm getting way too far into the weeds. But this is an example, it's a case of the manner in which people are mobilizing material and intellectual resources in the world and forms of self-stylization. So I'm an anthropologist, I like subjectivation, the way in which people create their own forms of subjectivity, by way of a set of assumptions, usually tacit, that the digital can afford you something in the biological.
But
so,
may I ask anything?
Yeah.
When you're talking about the self-stylization, I mean, are you talking also about the sort of emergence of a new scientific subjectivity?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, like, in the
I don't know if I would call it scientific subjectivity.
I mean, I'm just thinking about, Dostin and Gallison.
But there's a whole new regime to the way in which I think something counts as a problem.
Yeah.
Where
I think
I understand living things.
Yeah,
in a kind of way. What I think is a reasonable question to ask. How the machinery works in the lab, how it doesn't
work. This happened before. In the 80s, when I was at Stanford, in the 90s, there was a big knowledge medical ontologies project with some of the best AI people at Stanford at that time.
I remember this as
Okay, so I was
because the boys that worked in synthetic biology, some of them came out of
the same questions, and psych came out of that period. Mm-hmm. Doug Lennon's project, and that's the only standing, only one left standing, basically, because basically all collapsed, because even though they had very sophisticated ways to basically draw functorial relationships category, this is what all CSI was about. Mm-hmm. The Stanford Center for Situated Language and Linguistics, and John Perry, I was around at the time, was the last-ditch effort to relativize those kinds of ontological computer science ontology projects, and they all failed because of what you just pointed out. Either you put in more and more category context to stabilize it, which meant that it ran into the real world, you discovered there is no actual comparators, or you strip it out and you get completely useless abstractions.
Yeah.
So that just failed.
So I've got two or three more case studies, so I need to name them other than to say, so people who are doing computer-aided design stuff in biology, I find quite interesting, and then...
What are they doing?
Companies like Autodesk, who have built CAD programs for engineering and other fields, are really interested in what the jargon gets called programmable matter.
Yeah.
Or like stuff in the world that functions on information. And so again, it's quite an interesting place to say, okay, the figure of information is circulating.
Yeah.
Well, operationally, what is, back to the praxeology meets ontology we're talking about this morning, is there's a way in which, we can sort of sneer at how thin their philosophy of information is, but it's quite interesting the way in which they're mobilizing it and the kinds of things they put into relationship. Folks who are studying fractals and smoke are like working alongside people who used
That's
to
true.
Be metabolic engineers.
Yeah. Well, people were optimistic about the substance theory of heat also for the longest time. You know what I mean? Because it was so well for so many centuries. And it's at some point, I'm hoping that people will just stop. I'm not gonna reduce everything to an algorithm. I'm not gonna keep trying anymore. It's a big fucking waste of time.
Here's the two steps that
it's so frustrating.
The two things that are important for me is from the point of view of cultural anthropology. The one is that the big players in high tech are now interested in this. Mm-hmm. And so the question isn't, are these theories of information or these algorithmic readings of living things, are they right, are they correct, are they systematic? The question is, to what extent are these major players going to create vectors within which only certain modes of reasoning are allowed to count?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
So
well, they're doing it now.
That's one.
Yeah, but they're doing it now, and we see it, right? I mean, that,
this
that's
is back
right
to
now.
The financialization and innovation versus growth.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can make money on it, that is, it's going
that's
to happen.
And
whether it works or not.
And you create an ever-receding horizon in which you think that the reason it's working isn't because living things don't work this way. The reason it's not working is because we don't have enough data.
Well, that's what I meant when I said these trees, these actually work. These work for,
they work, but they only do certain...
Yeah, for certain,
right.
You
get opportunity costs.
Right, exactly.
And so this was step two, was to say that, I think around this interfaces that we mentioned this morning between personalized medicine, big data, and genomics, this is one of these spaces
in which constraints
are allowing certain things to happen at the cost of lots of other potentials.
Yeah.
Do you detect game in any strong movements of kind of cynical reason look, we know that life doesn't work this way.
Oh,
that's
absolutely.
Not the fucking issue.
Yeah.
That's right.
The issue is this is going to be big.
The speech, that's right. The speech acts, their disavowal, who's the guy at Stanford wrote this beautiful book on the bourgeois, Frank Minetti, no, what's his name?
Oh, Moretti. Yeah, he was on my dissertation committee.
Oh, no shit. Yeah. So he writes this book on the bourgeoisie, and he's just like, what do the bourgeoisie do better than everybody else? Like, disavow. Disavow is the characteristic moral trait of the bourgeoisie. And this is when the smart biologists start hanging out at places like Singularity University, you say, like, Kurzweil just told us that, A, B, and C, and he says that that's why synthetic biology is going to unleash the abundant economy. Like, what do you make of all of that? They're like, oh, this nonsense. And so then the fact that they disavow it is sort of an interesting social fact, but it means that the machinery that's making all of this operate as it were, an intuitive global that's going to control lots of other little variables isn't the intentions of the biologist.
And that's why I like the way that you're coming at these problems, because at the bottom, at the end of the day, it's not about what people believe.
Yeah.
It's about something structural. It's about these milieus. It's about these cultures. Where people can say,
yeah, what works.
What works. You know,
and what can be made to work.
What works in the interest of financialized lay capital, not in terms of understanding life.
So just an example of what works structurally. One of the, of course, interesting things in the recent history of technology, which some of you know better than I do, is. Like all of these questions about, okay, why the fuck did the personal computer come out of the mid-peninsula and not a place like Cambridge, Massachusetts? Yeah. What the hell is going on? Yeah. Well, one of the things that's going on, which Fred Turner and others have shown, is that there's a kind of ethos of the countercultural revolution. The Esalen culture comes to the valley, and they're looking at computers as modes of self-actualization, for that's not the only thing that's going on. But now, like, I can listen to a speech act by somebody like Mark Zuckerberg about what technology is doing for the world, and we all roll our eyes and we think he's full of shit, like, you know. But like, roll the clock back, like, that's a pure play out of like Maslow's self-actualization. So one of the answers to the question, why the hell did this happen in Silicon Valley rather than somewhere else, is because there's an ethos there. It doesn't exist. Why does that matter? Because around this question of how biology is being made to be subservient to a kind of high-tech imaginary, it means that biology is also being inculcated into a certain kind of ethos.
Mm-hmm. What's kind of fascinating about this particular story, and so you've done a really good job for me describing kind of the dominant ethos of what's going on here. But I bet there's a lot of little communities that you can then go plug into that are gonna really help you flesh out the relationship between ethos and practice.
That's exactly right. So thank you. So okay, this is the transition for me. I take very seriously Nietzsche's provocation that says, to destroy one must create. Okay, it's not enough to denounce, Nietzsche says. It's not enough for me to walk around a biotech company and say, a biobrick, it fucking doesn't work that way.
Right,
much more interesting is like, okay, trying something else. And so I've been really on the lookout for technologists in general and biotechnologists in particular who have a much richer feel for the living and ask how they're engineering in a manner that is secessionary relative to these dominant ethos. And so one strategy for me in doing this is to say, okay, like, I've got to get out of the Silicon Valley chatterbox about like what counts as innovation or non-innovation, as the case may be. And so I've been taking these trips to Israel and just talking to technologists, entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, biologists about like what does it mean to make technology in Israel? Because I want a different story about why it's significant and what you pay attention to and what you care about and how you think all this operates. Part of that is just because the Israeli technology story is super interesting and they're really fun, super smart people to talk to and listen to what they're up to. But also is to kind of create this sort of counter narrative about what is significant in the making of new technologies and therefore what is the cultural vector within which you're imagining living things as a potential technology.
Cool. That's awesome.
It's fantastic. And I think that's actually that kind of rhetorical movement is something that we're all sharing.
Yeah.
In how we're doing our analysis. Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. You know, one thing I just want to chime in before we, because I love, this is all very cool to me. I've often wondered why it is that some of the most groundbreaking innovations that have produced the most exciting new potential that were not pre-statable, at least in tech, let's just say. Because you asked, why does it all come from Silicon Valley? It didn't really come from Silicon Valley. It came from Norristown, Pennsylvania. It was MOS Technology, this tiny little company that made a really cheap microprocessor, right, the 6502, which competed with Intel's 8088. The idea behind that was, hey, we make this thing cheap, everyone's going to be able to have a personal computer in the home. And there was not one financial model. All the big companies were pitched this. They all said no. They said no. People wouldn't know what to do with a computer.
Yeah.
No one's going to care.
Yeah.
So by some weird confluence of just complete random chance, this really cool guy who wanted to design a cheap-ass processor, for no reason, no particular reason, got together with this Polish immigrant who founded Commodore, who built calculators, who just wanted to make money on some new product, somehow got him to say yes. That produced the 6502, which then led to Apple and all the cheap PCs. And there's no reason behind it. Like, nothing, there was no, nobody knew what to do with these computers. And it was these crazy guys who had no business model. They didn't even know what the hell they were doing other than, hey, we can do this, let's do it. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, all these new possibilities exploded. That's what makes me, and Park is the other example.
That's right.
It's so crazy.
That's right, because there really is a multiplicity of genealogies that get reconfigured and attached to certain kinds of gravitational centers that allow for these scale.
And I remember as a kid, because I got my first Commodore 64 when I was a kid, first computer, amazing. Yeah.
Programming the change, the color screen change.
It would come with
like,
a big
manual. Whoa, I just got like lime green.
But it would come with a manual that would teach you how to program. It was a big, thick manual. And no one knew what the fuck to do with this thing, yet everyone wanted one. Everyone had to have one of these things.
Yeah.
And we would just, and it was like this amazing, I don't know, it's like, again, an unprestatable potentiality where you could, it was a tangible example of that. It's like, I have this thing where I don't even know what the hell I can do.
Yeah.
But that is enough to make me want to spend $300 to buy this thing.
Yeah.
And when else do you ever see that?
Yeah,
it's
in
so
the,
rare
in the 1960s, this is the unprecedented thing. In the 1960s, you have people like Doug Engelbert and others in Stanford who are sort of a micro version of the office park or the research parks in which like, okay, like the DoD is going to like throw some money at these really smart people to like work on their pet projects and kind of hover at the edge to see whether or not a missile technology will come out of this. And meanwhile, they're all like super in love with Vannevar Bush.
Yeah.
And it's like a mimic. Whoa, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
And then they like literally are going to Esalen and dropping acid and having Maslow tell them you know, if you achieve total control of your own psyche, you will discover that your psyche is coextensive with all psychic energy, and that the control of your own capacities is simultaneously a linkage to the cosmic self. And they're like, whoa, shit, dude, like, that's Vannevar Bush. We can program that shit.
It's Sergeant Peppers, too.
And there's also a technology story, and they were super smart, and there's lots of mathematics, and there was money sloshing around, and there was, so it's not just the counterculture, but there's this way in which, there's these weird convergences that allow for the possibility of something.
The biggest fans of the PC in Bay Area were hippies.
They were hippies.
They even tried to develop their own computer company. I forget what it was called, but it was this idea of the hippie computer company.
Yeah.
Wow. And that's amazing to me. We don't have that anymore. I mean, now all we have are these idiots building apps to do stuff that nobody needs. It's just sort of like...
And save the world.
Yes, and save the world. It's like everyone's restricted their ideas of what's possible to what's actual now in the technology.
And I think that's why we're stuck. I do think that the inflated self-love of Silicon Valley, which keeps it blind from things like we're not really innovating, is the same culture that's providing the energy to transform biotechnology in the image of high-tech.
Yeah, it's
the self-congratulations and wealth of the high-tech industry is the driver
I'm still a biologist.
Yeah.
So, for example, I started in developmental biology, medicine and developmental biology. Is anything that is going on in this biotech synthetic biology area that you're talking about have anything whatsoever to do with, for example, how a zygote develops into an adult?
Yeah.
Does that have anything to do with the origin of life? Does that have anything to do with what life is?
Yeah, no.
It's just doing things. My sense is listening to you and looking at it distantly. It's doing what is technologically possible. It started with synthetic biology.
Yes.
I remember when the first little genetic circuits were engineered. I mean, the little oscillator that whoever it is made.
Yeah.
You know, the three genes that repress one another and oscillate.
Yeah, that's right.
I guess it's called the oscillator or something like
that. Yeah, what's his name? Caltech.
Yeah, I can't remember. Isn't it an awful lot of just doing what's technologically possible?
Mm.
It has no fundamental bearing on biology as a science.
No, I don't know. I think the only bearing it has on biology as a science is it's restricting the space within which biologists talk about and justify their work such that they get funding.
I think it's also changed such fundamental things of what it comes to know in biology.
What it comes to know, right?
Because now what it comes to know.
And that's huge.
And that's huge.
That's huge.
Is you have to build it to know it.
And you know, in 2000, there was something quite elegant about this. This was a pushback of blue collar biology. The techs of the bench were like, fuck you with all your theories. I can build DNA. And you can't. I'm really good at building DNA. And so there's this blue collar attitude that says, like, and then they pick up on this, this precisely on this attitude that, like, you don't understand it until you build it, or, you know, the one liner that I used to love from Jurendi was, I don't care how living things work, I want to know how living things can be made to work.
Exactly.
That's iterative, that's not about understanding.
That's it.
Right.
That's what he would say.
That really describes the whole
back to the basic sciences, it's why I left the synthetic biologist, and one reason why I left the synthetic biologist in the Bay Area and went to the basic sciences in perpetual, I had an opportunity, you don't say no to that kind of opportunity. But also just because I was quite interested in the fact that this is this enclave of people like Roger Byrne who are like deeply ascetic about what it means to be a basic biologist. I mean, Roger's like, no, I want to know the truth. And I'm quite interested in how the forms of living for somebody like Roger Byrne are being changed by the pressure of these other institutions.
Yeah.
How does he get along with, like, with Church and those guys?
Oh, he can't stand them.
I didn't think so. Yeah.
He can't stand them.
I mean, another, just what you're saying, another cultural thematization of this that I think would have a lot of public play. I mean, who started the Long Now Foundation? Stuart Brand.
Exactly,
so all the de-extinction stuff, he's putting
a
shitload of money into this, and he's got crackerjack scientists.
It's not nothing.
No,
Fred Turner's.
So there's a kind of an ecological, you know,
this is
environmental ethics kind of dimension.
Well,
this
is, and this is the fact of that the same sets of players that transform the personal computing experimentation from a hippie culture enclave to an industry turns out to be the same sets of players that get so excited about synthetic biology.
Yeah.
So isn't de-extinction sense the opposite of potential, because it's just looking at what's already happened, just making another duplicate of it rather than affording life or enabling novel.
Yeah, I mean...
But the de-extinction people will say, you know, why is it that the environmentalists should love us precisely because we're like contributing to biocomplexity by returning species.
So does anybody want a glass with their beer?
Or glass without beer?
That's about
glass without
beer. Phil's like, I have a question.
I have a real question. That's a question.
All right.
Are you thinking of break?
Stop talking.
I think we're transitioning.
Break.
Is it?
Okay.
Kilt lifter, I've had some of that recently.
That's good.
Oh, we're out,
Matt. All right.
Voodoo Ranger. That's
good.